Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Talent Game podcast. I'm your host, Joe Burridge, and with me today is Nick Walker. Welcome to the podcast, Nick.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And for our listeners who have no idea who you are, please go ahead and introduce yourself.
So I'm Nick. I consult at the junction of games and sustainability and technology. I was formerly the COO and before that the head of technical operations at Space Ape Games for 9 years. I spent a lot of that time managing technical teams, found that I really enjoyed it. My other big passion coming out of Space Ape is sustainability and how the games industry can be a global player in that space. Like, we've got a billion people playing our games. It feels like we should be able to do something with that platform.
Yeah, totally agree. And I've only really just learned about sustainability in games because I never really thought about the trickle down effect, right? Like I make software. I've got this large global footprint. And was like, okay, well, if you think about all the devices to play games and these sorts of things, and all of the warehouses housing all the servers and everything, it's like, it's mad.
These data centers, and like everybody's got to charge their phones or they've got to run their PlayStations. It was a very interesting way that the sort of powers that be, the people that invented the standards for this, invented this kind of concept of value chain emissions. So you're not just responsible for, you know, your people coming to the office and, you know, heating the office and stuff. You're also responsible for all of the energy that is used to play your games, which is a very different way of thinking about things.
Yeah, fascinating. Great, thanks for that overview. And for anyone listening who knows anything about my career, that they'll know that I was also at Space Ape for just a short amount of time, but we only, I think, crossed over for like 5 days or something like that.
That's
I think it was my first week was your last week, so
I'm glad we had such an impact on each other.
Yeah. See, I arrived and you're like, that's it, I'm out of here.
I'm out. Joe's here. I'm done. <cooked. laughs>
Yeah. One of the questions I always kick off with is, what are you playing right now?
So I'm going to ignore the fact that I'm a filthy FPS player, although I am dipping into the sort of Black Ops 6 beta just a little bit. I've just finished like kind of 200-hour plays where I really got into two games. One of them was Balatro, which is just about to hit mobile and wreck everyone's productivity because that game is absolutely brilliant. And the other one was Disco Elysium, which I waited on. I sat on and people kept recommending it. Finally, I played it and oh my God, it's amazing. It's so good.
That's so funny you mentioned those two games, right? I've literally just downloaded Disco Elysium because same thing, right? Like, it's always right there, most highly rated games, and I was just speaking to someone just the other day and they were like, oh, my favorite game of all time is Disco Elysium, and I was like, oh man, I need to get involved with it. By the way, I have a physical Balatro deck just off to the side.
I keep seeing them pop up, and they are very tempting. I think that it kind of feels like a universe that he built inside a card game, which is almost impossible, but you feel like there's a real solid universe out there of magic and weirdness and kind of esoterica that really just keeps you there. I loved it.
Yeah. So it's just funny you mentioned that because I think we're on track for me to say that was my favorite game of the year. So it's just interesting that you also called that out.
Well, and 20 wait, million wait till you finish downloads. Disco Elysium.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
we can come back and do a lore podcast on Disco Elysium afterwards because that I feel like I need to watch some serious videos to kind of unpick what just happened. It's so good. It's so good.
Awesome. And the art style as well. Such a unique art style.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Incredible.
But yeah, I definitely feel like I could talk about Balatro a lot. But it's had 20 million downloads. No, solo developer, 20 million downloads. And it's only just about to hit mobile at the end of September. What a story.
It's phenomenal.
I'm a massive poker fan anyway, so I run a poker club.
Oh, wow. So you're coming at it from that angle. Because I tend not to enjoy these kind of games, actually. Or it turns out that I really do. And maybe I've just been saved from them by the themes and things. But yeah, I just thought, you know, I'll give it a shot. Someone recommended it. My partner can't stand the theme music anymore. I had to turn that off. She just lost her mind every...
Yeah, yeah.
But it's great.
That's funny. I also had to play it on mute for the exact same reason. talking of games. You were at Space Ave for just over 9 years. And that was your first, first time in the games industry for your career, right?
That's right.
How did that happen? How did you get into Space Ape? I think interestingly, how did you progress to COO as well?
I mean, yeah, good question. I have always been attracted by the junction of creativity and technology. And so I was a technologist for a long time. I'd worked in all kinds of businesses, ISPs and sort of marketing places. And I ended up in digital marketing for a good few years where I sort of enjoyed helping build and host these sort of products that we were making. But I finished up there and I thought, you know what, I really want to work in a startup somewhere in that junction of creativity. And so I spoke to the recruiter at the time and I just briefed him. I said, look, I want somewhere that's just starting to scale. Maybe the CTO is too busy to handle like the operation side of things, the running of the servers. Maybe there's a team or two. And I think it was the first thing he came back with. And he just said, here, look, go speak to these people at Space Ape. Had a really intense interview. So it was like really like a lot of folk to talk to. There was, you know, just make sure this guy's okay. And I spoke to the team. I spoke to the CTO. I spoke to the founders, recruiters, all sorts of people there. And I have never wanted a role more than I wanted this one. It seemed exactly up my alley. And so I joined and ran a couple of the teams there. I ran an IT team and I ran a team that we call DevOps even to this day, even though I think that the term is probably well out of date now. I think sort of a platform team is a better way of thinking about them. But I spent a lot of time doing that and really getting into the kind of people management side of things. Because I think one of the things I've realized at Space Ape is that people are absolutely incredible. They're so smart. And so focusing on my strengths, which was organizing and getting people, you know, aligned and making sure that the right kind of work was done and making sure everyone was happy, was what I focused on, and to let those really smart technologists start to figure out what we needed to do to host these games, keep them up and keep them running a decent cost rate as well. That's how I ended up there. And then I think if you're a curious person, if you'd like to know how the world works, then it's you've got a space at Space Ape to kind of do that. So you're kind of encouraged, especially in a small business and a small studio like that, to kind of pick up, you know, wear other hats, as we used to say. And so I started to pick up lots of other hats. I picked up sort of the privacy and data stuff, and I picked up sort of a bit of the sort of speaking. So I'd help run these offsites that we do. And in the end, I sort of was just running sort of what I call the business outcomes bit of that, which is what are the sessions we're going to put everyone through? What do they want to talk about? Who's going to run them? All that sort of thing. So sort of put that hat on as well and put the sort of people management hat on and put the, you know, eventually the CTO at the time, Toby, left. And we created this sort of Borged CTO out of three of us who were sort of all doing different bits of this role. And that worked pretty well for a while. And eventually I sort of put on some more hats over in sustainability. And so by the end, I kind of had this position which was sort of we wanted a CTO, so we have the three of us, we sort of put Alessandro in that role, who's a great CTO, fantastic colleague, and like, well, what do we do about Nick, you know? And quite often COOs are a really funny breed because there's no two that are the same. Like CTOs tend to be kind of, you understand what their job is, right? COOs are all over the shop. They can be anything. They could be, you know, a financy COO, or they could be a producty one, which is more common in games. And for me, I think the role I took on was kind of like, how can we take the people management and the kind of well-being and performance that we've got in the technology side of the business and kind of place that, like, encourage that around the rest of the business. So I spent a bit of time doing that, carried on with sustainability and some of the data stuff and all sorts of other things. Ran another Ape Escape, as we call them, our big offsites, where we did an unconference which was absolutely wild and well worth doing. And then having come to the end of my road after, I think after 9 years at Space Ape, you kind of, I kind of felt like the overlap of what I wanted to do and what the business needed came to an end. And I was like, right, okay, let's go push this out to the world. And like, what can I take from my time at Space Ape and encourage in other studios and other businesses?
Thanks for that overview. And yeah, thank you. That was awesome. There's so many bits to like unpack in there. And
Yeah,
also
sorry.
really I don't apologize. That was good. And really exciting about this next chapter, like I said, really focusing in on like sharing all of that incredible knowledge and experience that you built up. A few thoughts there. That recruiter who came back to you immediately with the perfect job. I mean, hats off to them. As one recruiter to another, whoever that person is, I don't know if you remember they are, but it was
I
like
do,
almost a
yeah.
decade ago. Yeah. Also the Space Ape people. So yeah, I mentioned I'd spent 3 months at Space Ape. Honestly, I wish I could have worked there longer, but this role at Play Ventures came up and I just had to take it. I went into the studio 2 days a week for those 3 months. It just blew my mind a bit on what culture could be within a games company. Even just John and Simon being right there, co-founders being right there and really easy to talk to. Just the vibe of the place and the inclusivity of it all and just being welcome. Day one, it was like, yeah, you're welcome. You're part of the gang. And there was I will always hold that company in such high regard. Just lovely, lovely place to be in. I think a real best in class for I think what not just games companies, but how companies should run from a culture perspective. That was the lesson I take away from it. Anyone ever asked me about what it was like to work there, I'm like, that is what I would I think all cultures should strive to be like. And your last point there about the COO differences, yeah, this is why I asked about that's why I specifically asked like, how did you get into that job? Because yeah, I just placed a COO in one of our portfolio companies, and it was like, yeah, that flavor had to be from the production side. And then speak to someone else who's a COO, it's like, yeah, from biz dev, someone from finance, someone from the technical operations side, like you came from. It's like, yeah, pick and choose, yeah, whatever discipline. You can become a COO if you are more operationally or big picture minded when it comes to a company. Would you agree?
That really is it. I think it often attracts generalists. So, and I feel like a bit of it, I'm a generalist with a bunch of specialties. I think those Venn diagrams I explained of like games, technology, and sustainability are my kind of specialties. But I've worn so many different hats, and you can kind of almost turn your hand to everything because you can develop a passion and really go deep on something. And then now you've got another hat you wear. Now you know all about, data privacy or GDPR or whatever, some kind of other aspect of the business. So yeah, and eventually that all adds up and you're like, oh yeah, you're probably a COO, aren't you? But then you go somewhere else and they're like, oh, we want this shape of COO. And you feel a bit like a pretender, you're like, well, I could do that there, but that's not me. That's not my shape at all. Mm. So yeah, it feels like you almost need a different set of nomenclature, like a different set of words to kind of explain COOs, it's like, oh, I'm that kind of flavor or I'm that kind of flavor,
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, we definitely could do some more definitions of that. but before we hit the record button, we were talking about that Space Ape culture. And of course, when you get to the point of being at the sea level, you are really helping to purposely craft that, both from just what does it feel like to work here, but also from like, are we operationally effective and a productive company? So that's not really a question, but I'm just throwing it back to you. it's not a question, just throwing it back to you on that topic. Like, do you have any like key takeaways from that time, specifically around culture and crafting the culture that the company wanted?
So make no mistake, it comes from the top. Like, it is the emergent properties of what the founders at Space Ape, John and Simon, wanted their business to look like. They hired really, really smart people. I feel like their hiring policies were just, let's find really awesome people, let's give them a huge amount of latitude to do what they need to do, and let them get really, really good at what they do. Give them that space, and almost at some in some ways bend over backwards to accommodate that, And there were some red lines, like, you had to come to the office, which is something we talked about before we hit record. And I think that what happens is that you get these people who are really passionate. They get really into their role, into their position, and they care, genuinely care about everyone around them. And then as the teams grew, and as the business grew, it was about making sure that, certainly on the technical side, that we did the right thing, like in terms of continuing to allow for that autonomy and the mastery of your sort of domain, and making sure that everyone had this unifying purpose, this goal that they were aiming for. It's from a guy, Dan Pink. I think he wrote a book on this, which sort of codifies this autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And I think that I'm not sure that anyone actually read that. It's almost like the kind of emergent properties of the way that John and Simon wanted to run that business, because what that allows you is it allows you to have a really thin management layer for the most part. So you don't need, every fifth person you hire to have a manager of them or whatever. You can kind of, because you're hiring people that can be autonomous, and that was one of our goals, like you might remember from your few months there, was that we really appreciate self-starters, people that can kind of just get on with things, see where the problems are and just get on it, or bring it up, or all that stuff. So I think when you hire all those people, you get a long way towards a good culture, for whatever that phrase means. So we within my teams, I think what I tried to do was sort of follow that up, because you see how the business is run from John and Simon and whoever, and you kind of follow suit, right? Because you sort of fit in and you do what they want. Or do you sort of mimic, essentially, you sort of ape what people are doing. So I gave the teams as much leeway to define what they needed to do, listen to what they were doing, what their goals were. Because we used OKRs, right? A pretty familiar system for a lot of folk. You set quarterly goals, and you set some key results, which are the kind of how you've achieved those goals. And we would trickle those down to all the teams. So every team kind of knew roughly where they were going. And it was always a bit odd in the sort of platform and engineering teams and things like that, and IT, because they're not part of a game. They're sort of a substrate upon which the rest of the business does its work. And so you'd have to be a bit creative about supporting the goals in those ways. But that gave people their purpose. And I think over time it showed itself as pretty decent retention on these teams. Like, people generally left because they were moving to a different country, or there was some big thing, or more commonly towards the end of my time there, people had been there for so long that they kind of bumped up against the edge of what the business could offer. They'd been there for a bunch of time, and they're like, well, if I want to be a super senior X, Y, or Z, there's no room for that. There's already a director of this or a head of that. So people run out of growth, and the business can only grow as fast as it grows. So I think the retention was a sort of outcome of these this way of managing people.
Great. So I scribbled down a bunch of notes here, so that's just in terms of a recap. So your initial point was culture is top down. Culture is top down. So and if you want to craft one purposefully, then you as the leadership team have to agree on what you want and what you don't want to see within that culture. So, and you define that, you communicate that, and then it trickles down. So you also mentioned
I would argue back on that a little bit and say that actually I feel like culture is an emergent property of the way that the founders are. Like, there's a personality or like a way of working that founders have, and it's they will have their own way of managing their directs in the or their exec team or senior leaders, and that's what trickles down. And I think to some extent that's learned, and to some extent that's innate. And I was like jury's out on how much of each, but I think I don't know that there was too much conscious effort put into defining a management technique, or that's very much after the fact. We're like, oh, you should, we should do one-to-ones every week, or we should do feedback every year. Just those things were layered on afterwards. I think that the culture comes from a much more diffuse, less especially in a startup at the very early days. Yeah. No one's got time to be writing a management tactics document or something,
Yeah, well, and that's what I was thinking about with the another point you made about you're scaling, so let's focus really on the hiring part of that, be really strict with the people that we are bringing in, because if you do that right every time, you just bring a bunch of people who together that are, like I said, smart, looking for autonomy and purpose, and align with the values of the business. You just bring a bunch of those people together, and really cool stuff happens around the culture.
Yeah.
Just naturally.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like that point, focusing on the hiring and as you bring people in.
Yeah.
By the way, that book, Dan Pink, I think that's Drive. Was that book?
Oh, yeah, that Drive. Might well be. Yeah.
That first week I was at Space Ape, yeah, John was like, here's a recommended reading list. So I literally read that book in my first week.
No way.
Yeah. So it's a great
book. Is it one
of
those books that kind of explains its idea in the first chapter, and then kind of just have to read the first chapter, right? And then it just sort of recapitulates it over and over again.
That's every single business book I ever read. It's first chapter, here's the idea, and then the next 10 chapters are just examples of it. But yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So, the three there, though, you said that were a real focus. So autonomy, mastery, and purpose. I really like those. Another thing you mentioned as well, which has a really big impact on culture, is you just flippantly mentioned required to be in office, right? And that's a big topic in itself. So I'd love to hear your take on that, the trade-offs that are there from a culture and business perspective and all of that. So yeah, what's your take on remote working and being in office and that whole beast of a time?
I mean, I working from home is great. I get to do laundry, and I can sort of hang it behind me during podcasts and things, but I think I spent more time in 2020 and 2021 talking about this over and over and over again with people throughout Space Ape. And it got frustrating because you're kind of having the same conversations with different people, and they've all got different views. And I think you have these sort of spectra of people's feelings. They either really want full remote and they never think they ever have to come to the office again, or there was a spectrum. Obviously, some people felt that, and some people felt we should be fully on site 5 days a week, get back to it, all this. And then somewhere in the middle, there's people who are 4-3-2-1. And once a month, even things like that. And then there was this spectrum of people who really strongly held those views and were passionate that I never need to come to the office again, and people who are passionate about everyone should be in, X days a week. And they may have a loosely held idea that, I'm not that bothered really, whether it's 2 or 3 or, one or whatever. And I think the conversations we had, and ultimately it came down to the founders to make the call. They had to walk a line. They had to walk a line where they're like, well, what's our hiring look like if the whole industry suddenly pivots to full remote? And at the same time, we had some studios going to 4 days a week, and we had, some going full remote and claiming that, no one's ever gonna move to London to work because they now live in their pad in Devon, was it? Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I get that. And then, people were like, when we were sort of doing this back to work, people were like, well, now I've got to pay for a train ticket to get in. God, that doesn't seem fair now. Like, I've been at home, I've been doing my job, we launched a game during COVID. How is this fair? And so basically nobody seemed happy because, we just had this huge array of responses whenever we surveyed people, which we do quite a lot at Space Ape. And that's just as an aside, a thing that every business should do is just ask lots of questions of their teams and just try and understand what they feel, because I think without that information, you find it very hard to make decisions. And this ends up being one of those decisions that really does define culture. And it defines it in kind of an unknowable way, because we were making these decisions before. You don't have vision of the future. You can't tell, like, is this just going to be back and forth between, you know, we're going to go back into some lockdown, or is the bit, you know, is all business going to flood towards fully remote? You know, where do we draw the line? And at Space8, we ended up with a 2 days in the office approach, and probably a little bit misaligned with the rest of certainly London is that we did it on a Monday and a Friday, and that was quite deliberate. We have always valued our Fridays in office, and we wanted that to continue. We have a, you know, a show and tell at the end of the week where people get up and share sort of what they've been up to and things, and it's a great opportunity to kind of really get together with the whole studio and understand what everyone's up to. And on the Monday is often those touch points in the week which are, you know, kicking off of sprints or planning meetings and things, which can go a lot more smoothly if you're all face to face, and that would work fine, right, in your head, like, oh yeah, everyone's in on a Monday or Friday, except that we had hired lots of people in lockdown that were remote, because, hey, we just had to hire people, or they were remote and they were going to move to London at some point in the future. And that didn't always happen. So we ended up with these meetings with, you know, 50 people in a big game team, and then 5 to 10 who were remote for various reasons. And it's almost the worst of all worlds, because you have this kind of hybrid thing where you've got people at the other end of a, you know, a bit of copper sort of, two times, three, four time zones away, who are, you know, kind of trying to interact with a massive room full of people, and it is just impossible. And it's much better at that point almost to be, you know, every one face per tile on a big Zoom meeting where you can sort of manage it a bit better. So I think that aspect of things still juries out, but I think forcing or asking or requiring people to be in on that Monday and Friday had a huge impact on the working week. I think that the vibe on a Monday, you get in, there's an energy, there's a lot of people around, and the work that you're doing, this isn't a day for studious, you know, coding and head down detail work. It's deliberately a day to catch up, to spend time with people. And then the rest of the week is really spent on that detail work. Mm. And obviously that spectrum I mentioned about people who prefer full remote and full on-site probably broadly maps to how much detail work you have in a week, how much, you know, if you're a developer, actually having a quiet office and a you know, pair of noise cancelling headphones and your own room to sort of sit and code in is immeasurably more productive than being in a busy office. And to some extent, I have no idea how anyone did it with 5 days a week in the office.
yeah, great. There's a bunch of takeaways there. So you mentioned about making that decision with the studio. So like surveying, being like, what does everyone's work patterns actually look like? Like, okay, so 2 days a week means that studio is the majority working from home, right? So, and then you've got, so 40% of the time in the office. But like I said, Mondays are packed full of like in-person, highly productive meetings. And then Fridays are much more of that social day, like, and then also that end of week celebrations. And by the way, those end of week meetings were always fantastic. Like so many insights in there, and just a chance to, and also I saw John do like the Ask Me Anythings, which sometimes were brutal. Like some people would throw in some really blunt questions, but it feels so much more empathetic when you're there in person listening or answering those questions. So sorry, you were about to say something. I cut you off.
Well, I think there's a, you touched on something there, which is number one, the anonymity definitely is important for being able to ask those frank questions. And John and Simon have never shied away from it. And I really appreciated that. And I think that the other important thing to note is that those Fridays, a lot of that was about transparency, like not just from teams, but John and Simon and others would be really transparent with the business about what was going on. And one of the sessions that I used to run most weeks, I guess, was this Hails and Farewells, which is comes from like military or like navy parlance, where you sort of welcome new people aboard your ship and you say goodbye to people going off to other ships or leaving the navy or whatever. And so we would sort of celebrate and talk about quite openly those moves and changes within the business, so that people knew and that people had the context that they needed to sort of understand why people wanted to leave the business or where they were going or what they're up to. And they had an opportunity at some point to come up and talk to it as well if they wanted to. So that transparency on that Friday, it just leaves people feeling pretty buzzy. And it's good. It's a good time because, you know, if you're finding out that you're someone you really appreciate and love in the business is leaving, you get a chance to go have a goodbye and a drink with them and sort of chat it out. And usually they were there for another month or two, but it's like still a great opportunity.
Yeah, great. I agree with all those things. And I think from, yeah, like I said, I'm in my pad in Devon. So I'm, you know, for those who don't know, UK geography, that's a good 250 miles west of London. And I worked remotely since the pandemic, basically, so 4.5 years now. But then going into the office, I was like, oh yeah, like this is why I love the games industry, like being surrounded by people in person. I'm a very extroverted person anyway, and I somehow kind of forgot that I get so much of my social battery filled up when I meet others. And also I think just being with your team, just from a really practical perspective, there was a lot of advantages there. But I think what Space Ape did well is that making those days really count. Like everyone's in on those 2 days. So it's like, okay, it's going to be really, really worth my time going into the office. It's not just like, oh, I'm forced to go in and I go in and there's no one here anyway. It's like, what is this all about? So I think that was done really well and really maximized employees' time and made it really, really worthwhile from just a really practical perspective. So
it was a learning process to get there, because we, during those bits in COVID where you could kind of come into the office, but you know, didn't want too many people in at once. So we would split the teams up, and the feedback was, because, you know, we asked for feedback, was this is pointless. We already spend all our time talking to these people. Like we don't need to come into the office as a team. What we need is other people in the business who we don't get to speak to. What are the other client developers doing? What are the other QA folk doing? And things like that. So that was the feedback we got, and that's why we concentrated everyone into 2 days, rather than just saying, hey, you need it in 2 days, work it out amongst yourselves, just come in whenever. Because that does lead to that thing that you have, where probably Mondays would be dead and everyone would be like just doing their morning stuff, Monday morning stuff in their own homes, and instead you just have this like sort of vibrant kickoff. Now I would say as well, you have to thanks for declaring your extroversion bias there, because I think there's a lot of people in a business, certainly in a business where there's a lot of technologists, where they're the opposite. Their social battery is very low. It may be zero, and they would much rather spend all that time. But I think that their contributions to those meetings and others seeing them around, there's a balance to be struck there. And that's the balance ultimately that you strike by saying, hey, 2 days a week minimum. And, you know, occasionally we'll ask you in for another day just in case there's a special event happening or something.
Yeah, definitely. And it's always good to remind myself of that bias. I'm like, what do you mean you don't want to be surrounded by everyone all the time and just talking nonstop?
So, exactly, right?
Fantastic. Thanks so much for going through all those pieces there on culture. We are actually getting pretty close to the end. That time is absolutely flown by. Before I get onto my final question, I just want to know, is there anything that we, is there any nuggets of info that you wanted to share that we didn't get in today with regards to culture, remote work, crafting high performance teams?
Do you want to talk about psychological safety?
I would love to talk about psychological safety. Yes,
it's certainly something I learned while I was at Space Ape, but there's this, I think it's quite important in operations, because like I grew up through a world of looking after, you know, individual servers where they had names. You'd call them things after like planets or Star Wars characters or something, right? And the impact of one of those servers dying was that people couldn't work. You know, their file system, whatever, that went down, or they couldn't do their email. And the typical response to that was, appropriation, blame, all these things. And I think growing up through that kind of raw operational life left me feeling quite, I suppose, sort of burnt a little bit by the reactions of people in the business to these things that were inevitable going down. And over time, technology's improved to this place where we've got these incredible systems that are self-healing and all this, but things still go wrong. And I think if there's anything that I've learned out from kind of running these operational teams is to make sure that the teams that you work with have the psychological safety to operate bravely. And I think that's how you can make progress in a team. So we've had absolutely diabolical outages in my time, not just at Space8, but other places where something really goes wrong. And it goes wrong for like some reason, but it's rarely some individual's reason. And I think making sure that everyone understands that when something goes wrong, it's not their fault. It's usually systemic. It's because they weren't given the cover that they needed. They weren't trained effectively. The tooling wasn't clear, or we hadn't got guardrails in place and things like that. So there's a huge amount, I think, in understanding psychological safety that really helps people take bold and brave steps in a business. And it doesn't just sit with operations, it can sit with other things. You should be able to fail. And the important thing is to have, retrospectives, conversations about these things and see, where they go wrong, why they go wrong, and what we can do to improve it. And it sounds really dumb to say it because I think, sprints, in agile methodology all has that built into it. But I'm not sure that people truly believe that's the reason. Often they're just looking for a way to make a process easier or simpler or something. But really, the underpinnings of all that to me, and the retrospectives and the loops of, iterating were to improve psychological safety, to make sure that people felt that even if stuff goes wrong, even if there's a bad sprint or there's an outage, that it's not their fault. It's just part of the challenge that we have to run these teams and to get work done effectively. And I think partly for me that comes from just the brutal the brutal upbringing I had in the raw 2000s and late 90s to kind of make these things work. But yeah, it's something I feel quite passionately about today. And I think we did a pretty good job of that at Space8, and we weren't a big blame culture. And I think that's important. I think if you're in a blame culture, try and find ways to sort of ameliorate that and make it better.
And that also comes back to your point about autonomy, mastery, purpose. Like, you can't be autonomous and you can't master your craft unless there is psychological safety, unless you are turning up to do your work motivated and feel like, okay, like part of mastery is making mistakes, but also learning from that, like correcting and learning fast. And if you're feeling anxious and putting so much brain power into feeling anxious and feeling
Right.
like, oh, I feel like I should be doing this because of bureaucracy, rather than like going with what you actually feel like is the correct course of action. That's where
Yeah.
also mistakes can be made, and mistakes that you are really not proud of because you didn't act into your true self anyway. So that's kind of how I see this psychological safety. Would you
I
agree with that
agree.
take?
I do big tick. I think as well it breeds trust, like this idea that if you have psychological safety, you're trusting that no one's going to come for you. You might be called upon to explain what happened and to give your account, but no one, there won't be recriminations. There won't be like professional sanctions levied against you because of it. And I think that trust is super important. It's one of the, I mean, going back to the conversation about, in office, one of the things we found that that started to fall away when we were all remote was trust. And it wasn't so much trust between people who had spent all those months in little tiles on Zoom. They kind of trusted each other. They were all on the same team. It was inter-team and management to team and those different things where they weren't spending time together. And that's one of the big reasons why we were so keen on like not having remote work, full remote. Like it just, I think you have to work really hard to build trust remotely. And so between those sort of aspects of psychological safety and trust, I think some of that needs to be proxied through human interaction. And for us, the easiest, the most brutal way to do that is like, hey, everyone's got to come to the office. All of this ends up being a conversation about culture. It's about the decisions you make and the emergent properties, just to link it back to that kind of initial thought we had. All of that is about those decisions that you make that then end up impacting culture in a business.
Yeah, and building empathy, removing that us and them mentality. No, it's just us here. And being, by the way, being at companies like EA and Epic, where I would straddle the corporate with the product, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm in the recruiting team, which is like the people team, which is often seen as like being the corporate side, but I'm like, I'm embedded there with the game studios, and they're like part of the, you know, they're part of the product team with Space Ape, or part of the Fortnite team, or part of the Need for Speed team, whatever it is. I'm like, I'm there, but it's like, yeah, I could only build that trust among everyone by being visible.
Exactly. And it breaks down silos. You're human. You know, I think, yeah, it's the hardest problem, I think, in businesses, to how do you, you know, it's that purpose aspect of autonomy, mastery, and purpose, is how do you get everyone hanging off that same purpose? How do they all feel that they've got this, you know, and that their own individual team aims aren't at odds with each other? And we had a very complicated, quite difficult to manage matrix organization to sort of handle that at Space Ape. And that starts to creak at 150. I think there's a whole other podcast in there about Dunbar's number and Conway's law and all sorts of fun things like that.
I was just about to say about Dunbar's number, but we are running out of time. I definitely, Nick, what I love about you is that I feel like we could chat like all day. And in fact, I hope that happens one time, at least Absolutely. One time in person sometime soon. Thank you. So many great takes on culture, psychological safety, crafting purposeful teams, remote work. But my last question for you today is, what is your favorite interview question?
So I'm not a fan of those catch out questions, and I think people put way too much like kind of pop psych analysis into that silly stuff. Like, what superpower would you have? You know, so for me, the best question is anything that gets a candidate to light up and share a bit of who they really are. And what I ask is, what are you passionate about? And partly this shows me very clearly how much of a connection we've made in our interview. And what I found is that a lot of people will clam up when you ask that question because they're kind of scared to kind of share their passion with you. And some people think that it's just got to be a work thing. I don't really mind. I just want to know if an interview's gone well, what people's eyes light up and they share something. And quite often it is their work and it's something that they're really passionate about in their work. And you get a sense of what makes them tick. Sometimes it's something completely mad that they love. Someone ended up showing me them riding a motorbike, but like doing tricks like wheelies and stuff on their motorbike, like a proper big, you know, like, you know, Yamaha, you know, these big things. And their eyes light up and suddenly there's this connection made. And I think that's really nice to make at the end of an interview. If you spent, you know, an hour and a half chatting to someone, it's nice to see them share a little bit back about themselves that makes them passionate. So yeah, that's one of the things I like to ask.
That's great. And I love that you've put that at the end, because so many people I know would ask that type of question at the beginning as like a something to warm up. In fact, I recall an exact interview at the beginning of my career being asked that right at the beginning. It was for a recruitment agency, and I was like, video games, obviously. yes. And the sales manager was like, okay. and I just went on this rant about video games. I still don't know how that landed. I like that you asked that at the end, because by the end of the interview, you like think you've settled into that conversation. If it's gone well, you settled into that conversation. And like I said, it could be something that at work, like what really drives you at work, or like this person who does wheelies on their motorbike, like, you know, a hobby or something, something, a really nice positive note to end on. And also you get to peel back that layer and get to know that person a bit more. Like, great question. Awesome. That is the end. Thank you so much, Nick. Really, really appreciate your time. So thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to commencing our Disco Elysium lore podcast in a few months when we finish the game. And thanks for having me. Yeah, appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks, Nick. Bye-bye.
Bye.